From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont author Stephen P. Kiernan, whose new novel is Universe of Two, published by William Morrow. Stephen P. Kiernan's newspaper work garnered more than 40 awards, including the George Polk Award and the Scripps Howard Award for Distinguished Service to the First Amendment. His first three novels are The Curiosity, now in television series development, The Baker's Secret, which was a regional indie bestseller, and The Hummingbird. He has also written two nonfiction books, Last Rites and Authentic Patriotism. His work has been translated into many languages, and he's also been on the show twice before. You can find those interviews in Write the Book's archives on the podcast site. A graduate of Middlebury College, Stephen P. Kiernan received a Master of Arts degree from Johns Hopkins University and a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. He has chaired the board of the Young Writers Project, served on the Vermont Legislative Committee on Pain and Palliative Care, and served on the advisory board of the New Hampshire Palliative Care Initiative. He has spoken and consulted around the country about hospice, palliative care, and advanced directives. He's also a musician and has recorded three CDs of solo guitar instrumentals and composed music for dance, the stage, and documentary films. He lives in Vermont with his two sons. Here's a little information about Universe of Two. Graduating from Harvard at the height of World War II, brilliant mathematician Charlie Fish is assigned to the Manhattan Project. Working with some of the age's greatest scientific minds, he is assigned the task of designing and building the detonator of the atomic bomb. As he performs that work, Charlie suffers a crisis of conscience, which his wife, Brenda, unaware of the true nature of Charlie's top-secret task, mistakes as self-doubt. She urges him to set aside his qualms and continue. Once the bombs strike, the feelings of culpability devastate him and Brenda. At the war's end, Charlie receives a scholarship to pursue a PhD in physics at Stanford, an opportunity he and Brenda hope will allow them a fresh start, but the past proves inescapable. Loosely, based on the life of the actual mathematician Charles B. Fisk, Universe of Two is an account of two people struggling to heal their consciences and find peace in a world forever changed. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Stephen P. Kiernan, with whom I spoke by phone last week. As I read Universe of Two, it became really clear to me that you were really working on two books, not just two narrative viewpoints, as you do, but there's the love story and there's the bomb. And I found it really interesting to think about the challenge of writing this book, bringing together those two threads as well as you do. I'm wondering how it was for you to combine these two threads as you worked.
This book was immensely, immensely difficult.
Yeah.
To tell you the honest truth. For a couple of reasons. One was that I had an enormous amount that I needed to learn just to be able to write the basics of some components of this. I had to learn about the development of the atomic bomb, not only what had occurred and how it works, but what the timetable was in each step in that process.
Right.
I needed to learn about soldering. It only occurs kind of in the background of 11 pages, but it was a skill that was necessary and also can be metaphorical. I had to learn about organs, both the kind of organs you can buy in a store and take home, and cathedral organs and church organs, which are infinitely more complex and in some ways as complicated as a bomb. I had to learn about submarine warfare in World War II. And, you know, all of these different things, I had to learn what Chicago was like in 1943. And weather in Santa Fe and the layout of the landscape in Los Alamos and so many things. And that was the first thing. The second thing was having a plot for the characters that moved at an appropriate novelistic pace within the reality of the dates of what happened in the war. This is the day on which FDR died. This is the day on which Germany surrendered, mm-hmm. and what their relationship would be doing in those moments. It was difficult to write a love story, a book that is an unabashed love story, when I was in romantic upheaval myself at the time.
Mm.
it was a challenge to take all those things that I learned in great detail and throw away everything that was going to slow the story down.
Yeah.
Or it was unnecessary for the reader to know and have it still make sense. And then there were the usual problems of, you know, can I make it vivid? Are these characters, you know, do they come to life? All those kinds of ongoing challenges. The result is that this book took me more than twice as long to write as any book I've written before. And, you know, it's my longest book. It's about 135,000 words. And I took out 52,000 words.
Wow.
So it was nearly double the length of my prior novel, The Baker's Secret. And that was having taken 50,000 words out.
Mm.
And they needed to go. They absolutely needed to go because I had to be in service of this story, which I think has a kind of density to it. You know, not that it's dense, but that it's full
mm-hmm.
all the time. And I especially want it to be emotionally full all the time. And so that if something was unnecessary, then it was like I'd be making a character walk around carrying a brick.
Right.
If he didn't need that brick, I got to put that brick down right away.
Right.
And it was a different revision process because if a scene, normally if I have a scene that doesn't work, I just work it and work it and work it and work it. And in this, if I had a scene that didn't work, gone.
Oh,
just
wow.
Cut it out.
Yeah.
And so it took a kind of ruthlessness. But what I can tell you is that I felt lighter and lighter as I did that. So I enjoyed the revision of this book more than any other.
Okay.
But it required tons of it. So yeah, it was difficult project.
Now, we should mention that the book concerns the fictional character, Charlie Fish, who's based loosely on the actual Charles Fisk, who worked on the Manhattan Project, and then his romantic interest is the fictional Brenda Doobie. So is she based on anyone from history?
No. And Charlie Fish is really only based on Charles Fisk to this extent. There was a man who went to Harvard and graduated young with a math degree and went to the University of Chicago to do work in the metallurgy department. And then he was promoted to the detonator team at Los Alamos. And after the war, he was given a full ride to Stanford to get a PhD in physics, which he quit after less than a semester.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up re-enrolling to take some courses in music and particularly in keyboards and organs. And he went off on to found an organ company that exists to this day and makes incredible, premium, magnificent instruments.
Okay.
And so that's all that I used of the actual Charles. And I did meet with his biographer and read about his history and speak to historians at Los Alamos and interview his daughter. And I realized that I didn't want to write a biography. I wanted to write a novel.
Okay.
So so I did no research on his wife. I think he actually had two wives, but at any rate, I did no research on that. I just took the kind of skeleton. In fact, what you raise is a larger question about writing historical fiction, which is how much do you hew to the historical record? And I feel like when it's a war, the moral responsibility to reflect what actually occurred in the war, the moral imperative for that is as high as it could be. So the acknowledgments part of this book is important for me because I clarify, it takes a couple of pages,
mm-hmm.
what is real and what is made up. And the answer is just about everything is real. A lot of the bomb stuff is way simplified,
mm-hmm.
as well as the organ stuff. I've really simplified it. And Charlie Fish is a fictional creation, and so is Brenda Doobie.
Okay. And then this is a kind of trivial thing, but I always find it interesting. How do you go about choosing character names? Now, obviously, Charlie Fish is very close to Charles Fisk. That made sense to me. But so for Brenda Doobie, how did you go about figuring out what she would be called?
You know, I looked at, I have kind of a arcane process and things occur to me and I work with them and then I get to know the character. And I will tell you, for example, that Charlie Fish was Archie Fish.
Mm.
He was Archie for a lot of the time. And then I realized, no, he really was a Charlie. And it's a silly thing, but I had to, he was more of a Charlie than he was an Archie. I wanted him to be a little bit further away, you know, because I didn't want direct comparison with the real human being who had lived. So with Brenda, I looked at names that were, you know, the most popular names in the time that she would have been born, which was the late 1920s. And, that was not a name with heirs, that she was the daughter of, a man who ran an organ and accordion and piano store in Chicago. And at night, his hobby was to tinker with ham radios and to repair the radios of his friends, soldering. So she was from a very much middle class, maybe lower middle class Chicago background. I wanted her to have kind of an ordinary name. And then I that was in terms of her first name. And I just called her Brenda as a working name, and she grew into that name. She's very Brenda. And her last name was that I didn't want overt ethnicity for her. And there is a ton of ethnicity in Chicago, as in many major cities, and that could have been an element of her character. But I didn't want that. I didn't want to sort of, I felt like that would be almost cheating to have her be of one particular ethnicity. Then it gives her a voice and a way of address. And I wanted her to be kind of more independent of that than to have any of those kind of immediate connotations. And I say that with all those words, but it's really very hunchy. And often I will change a character's name in the course of a book because I realize who they really are.
Yeah.
And that's fun when I feel like this weight, like, no, that's really not the name. And I have to stop and go, what is this person's name? It's not Archie. He's just not an Archie. And for anyone who's read the book, they'd know. He's not an Archie. He's a Charlie.
Yeah.
However that is so, whatever that distinction is, I felt it very much about 100 pages in. To make the change.
That's fun. That's great. So these are the first two sentences in the book. I met Charlie Fish in Chicago in the fall of 1943. First I dismissed him, then I liked him, then I ruined him, then I saved him. So I that right away just made me happy, made me smile as a writer and a reader. And I wondered if you could talk about opening in this way, and then also just talk a little bit about what constitutes a satisfying opening to you when you're a reader, when you're reading.
I think the next sentence matters too, if I can be vain about it.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, go ahead.
In return, he taught me what love was, lust too, and above all, what it is to have a powerful conscience. I feel like for me, this book, I struggle with beginnings and endings, and this book, I like my beginning and ending more than probably any other book I've written. And because I feel like in this one, I am introducing you to the character and the time and the place, but I'm also making promises to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
When I say, you know, first I dismissed him, then I liked him, then I ruined him, then I saved him. I've just declared to you the arc of this novel.
Right.
And right. I've just said, this is what I'm going to deliver. And then when she says, and what he gave me was love and lust and conscience. Like, there it is. There are the seven ingredients of this book.
Right.
And I could only write that beginning after I'd written the whole book. It's why I love revision. That whole first four or five paragraphs could only have occurred when I really knew the whole story.
Okay.
So I didn't know about lust, for example, that would be part of this story.
Uh-huh.
Until I got to the point where you have a young couple, 21 and 22, newly married and no privacy. What happens to them?
Right.
And so, that was like the most confident opening I've used for a novel, because by then I knew that I would be able to keep that promise. And so it feels to me like I'm almost like shaking hands with the reader. I'm saying, here, I'm in, and this is what I'm going to do or attempt to do.
Okay.
And come with me. And it's also Brenda just being her plain spoken self, that she can say, I dismissed him, I liked him, I ruined him, I saved him. It's so much her personality, know?
It's right.
Just like, matter of fact, I dismissed him. You know, that's like her arrogant element. And I liked him, which is her likable. And then a personality. And then I ruined him, which is her taking kind of responsibility for her culpability and his heartbreak.
Yeah.
And then I rescued him because she was completely in love with him. And there's the arc of the novel. And, you know, I'm only 20 words into this thing and my whole heart's already on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we won't talk about how she did each of those things. But as I hit each of those moments, I'm like, ah, here we are.
Yes.
Now, from that opening, which gives us a very brief summary and, as you say, an arc of their story, you do this incredible job of moving us into scene. You write, how did it start? As innocently as the chiming of a bell when a shop door opens. I was in the back office, and then all of a sudden we're in a scene. And I thought that was such a skillful transition, which I think can be hard. Transitions can be hard. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about handling transitions and moving in and out of scene.
Let's see. That's more technical than I usually talk about, but I will tell you that I sometimes think cinematically. Mm-hmm. And so I think of her, for example, in the moment that you just read, that she's in the back office and the bell rings. If I were director, I would have her in the back office. What she's doing is wrestling with a package that won't unwrap, that's been overtaped, and she's frustrated. And then I would just have a camera shoot, just a little ding-a-ling-a-ling of the bell ringing when the shop door opens.
Yeah,
I'd make it a mystery who comes in too, you know? And so I think about, like, how would that look? And here's the goal. Galway Canelo said that the book is only half the transaction, and the other half is what occurs in the reader's imagination, right? So what when I go into scene, I'm not trying to write the entire scene. I'm not. I'm trying to write about half, if I can, even like a third, and then let the reader be the director of the cinematic experience. Let the reader's imagination get engaged, because I think, first of all, every reader does it differently. And second of all, they have their own idea of what that bell sounds like. Mm-hmm. And secondly, as they begin to imagine the novel, we're still on the first page here, Sheila, you know, so they're beginning to imagine this story, and they will forget that this is black marks on a white page. They will forget there's an author. They will forget there's a book in their hand. A dream will begin. A continuous imagined dream will begin in their minds and hearts. If it works. And that means that when they have to put the book down, they don't want to, and the characters stay with them, and they might be away from that book for a week because it's a busy week, and they pick it up, and in three sentences, they're back in the dream. And as they get near the end, they don't want the dream to end. And when the book is done, the dream, they have this feeling of the dream being over, which has this beautiful kind of bittersweetness. Like, all of that, I think, happens only if they make the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very technical thing. How do you get in and out of scene? The question is really, like, how do you provide enough to bring the reader effortlessly into imagining the scene?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's the art of it. That's a thing I worked very hard on. And, you know, how to begin every chapter.
Yeah.
You know, how to bring them into, here's something different. And especially this book has two narrative voices. And so, like, I want that transition after the first two or three times to be painless. Oh, is Brenda speaking again? Great. I know right where I am in the first three words, and let's go, Brenda.
Now, that's an interesting point. When you're writing, do you ever, like, just read every other chapter all in a line to see how, for example, Brenda's narrative point of view, which was first person, all lines up without the interruptions of Charlie's point of view, which is third person, which, you know, is how the book beautifully works. But I'm just curious, do you ever read them as one?
Not sequentially like that, but I will very often read a later scene, by which time I know the character very well.
Mm-hmm.
Literally read it aloud,
mm-hmm.
and then I will go back to an earlier one and read it and see if they align.
Oh, okay.
And so, for example, there's a verbal tic that Brenda does, which is that she'll say a very long sentence, period, which was an idea that I had a long time ago, and that which was that additional kind of clause. That is, there's an incomplete sentence, but that she puts after long sentences is a way that she thinks and speaks.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I didn't invent that. She just did that. It came out in her voice that she had more to say,
mm-hmm.
and it would not be a complete sentence. But and you know, so once you realize that, and you're 300 pages in, you say, well, she needs to speak that way on page one, and in fact, she does. She says, which only goes to show you how much a 19-year-old girl knows about anything.
Yeah,
and that's not like me being facile. That's me making her kind of congruent.
Right.
All the way through. So I do that. I don't read the chapters apart, but I will look at scenes, like how does she always behave when she's speaking with her mother?
Okay. All right.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier all the research you had to do, and I'm just curious how you did research on the vocabulary, the lingo of the times, you know, like... The words are so fun, you know, it's the Follies and the Boys and a Pal and hijinks and like words that we just don't use anymore. So did you watch a lot of old films or did you read old magazines?
You know, I told myself I was not allowed to say shenanigans. you know, the answer is that I looked at books of the time, especially films of the time. I looked at a bunch of newsreels,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, was how a lot of people, I mean, were pre-TV. So if you didn't read the newspaper, how did you get the news? You know, and these newsreels, when you went, you know, people would go to the movies every weekend. and every Saturday. So that's how they would get their news at the beginning of it. Well, you look at the language in there, really jingoistic war stuff, propaganda stuff, but also they'd have, you know, I don't know, Jimmy Cagney getting the Academy Award for Best Actor and what he'd say. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that was where a lot of those words came from. And what I found is those words are delicious because they are not of our time. And so it was an interesting thing to think about, for example, referring to young men as boys and young women as girls.
Yes.
And that would stand out. And that it had to be okay, because that's how it was. And, you know, women might what we would call, women's group, you know, a woman would arrive and say, hello, girls.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that probably wouldn't happen today. But it was part of familiarity and the colloquialism of the time.
The other thing I noticed was nicknames, a lot of nicknames. And I realized that is a thing from that time. And of course, we still have nicknames today, but not as much, not so widespread. Do you agree?
I do.
Yeah,
I do. Yes, everyone had nicknames, and there were usually very artful. That there was an element of kind of being derogatory, an element of being complimentary, and really what it was about was familiarity.
Yeah,
that we have our own special name for each other.
Yeah, yeah. Although sometimes we didn't want the name we were given, and I won't go there.
Correct.
I loved your use of Brenda's perfect pitch for both character development and sometimes humor. It just was one of those character details that worked so well. You know, sometimes you just find the right thing to do for somebody. And I wondered, when in the process of drafting, did you think of giving her perfect pitch? And did that come in even handier maybe than you might have expected?
It did. And, you know, I am a musician. I don't play keyboards as Brenda does. I play stringed instruments and it was, but it was really great fun for me to have a real pleasure and enhancement for me to have music all through this novel in mm-hmm. lots of different forms, particularly the one piece that she's trying to learn to play for the entire 2.5 years in which the novel takes place.
Yeah.
And really for the rest of her life, learning to play this. And so if you went back and looked at, like, for example, the songs that she plays, and you went and listened to a recording of those songs, it's like, you know, cheek to cheek, dan 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 dan, you know, it's all this kind of cheeky, brassy kind of Chicago 1943 stuff.
Right.
And Charlie wants her to play Chopin. You know, he wants her to play beautiful things because when she does that, she's beautiful to him and unaware of her beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really got to use that. There's one point where she just is so sad and she doesn't know how to improvise. So she's just playing B flat to G minor chords really slowly while repeating a high D, which is in both chords. You don't have to sit at a keyboard to appreciate the melancholy of that. But anybody who does, the music holds up all the way through. That was enormously fun.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I made a Spotify playlist for people, you know, for any of your listeners who are on Spotify. It's called Universe of Two. And it's an open playlist. And it's just some of the music that occurs in this book because that was such an enriching element for me.
I remember that scene, and I remember her mother's reaction to that scene was just very moving. I want to talk about her mother later. Let's see. So I know it's hard to maybe explain mining your fictional world for details, but I have a question about this. So here's one moment. Brenda and her family, as you say, have this shop where they sell organs, and Brenda plays sometimes to kind of wow the customers and encourage them to buy. And in one scene, she slips out of her shoes so as not to scuff the bass pedal. So that kind of detail, I just am so admiring of that kind of detail. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about finding those details that speak to the character, speak to the moment, speak to the situation, speak to the times. I don't know if that's something we can talk about.
Sure. You know, it's one of my absolutely favorite things about researching for a novel.
Yeah.
Is looking for something like that. So I can tell you that particular moment came because I saw a demonstration of a magnificent organ that is in the Memorial Chapel at Stanford University. And the organist there, who helped me by telling me some about how organs worked and telling me about different pieces that I could listen to that might be useful in the book and so on. I was watching a videotape of him and while he was talking about demonstrating this one organ. And at one point, for about a second, the camera panned down and he was playing the pedals beautiful pedals of this multi-million dollar organ with these very, very soft, super soft, like calfskin leather slippers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not to market. And I thought, oh, that is just so perfect. I forget everything else about the bass pedals, that. And so I have Brenda play with her stockings, yes. I'll tell you another one that was a favorite of mine.
Yeah.
You know, in Los Alamos, where the atomic bomb was designed and built, that was the largest congregation in a single community of Nobel Prize winners ever in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the most PhDs in those fields in one place, certainly more than any university today, for example, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and doctoral students, all of that brain power, and yet the milk was always sour.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all of that genius, all of that brain power, but the place is primitive enough that they didn't have decent refrigeration. And when I learned that, I suddenly understood. I understood what the culture of this place was like. And that for all the grandeur and genius, the milk was sour, like a completely offensive thing that any human would recoil from. And so when I'm doing the research, I do need to know the dates and the numbers and things like that. For my own edification, the reader's never going to see any of that. It's just that I make sure that I'm with it, you know, reflecting reality. But when I see one of those little jewels, oh, I just pounce on it.
Yeah.
So literally that moment of her playing, taking her shoes off, came because of the university organist at Stanford.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Now, Brenda's point of view moves through time as well as space. So she says things like, I remember one spring when I was still in my 60s, and it goes on from there. So that was interesting to me that you chose to have her be offering a retrospective narration. And I wondered if you want to talk about that decision.
Yes, I think that's part of the promise in the beginning of the book, is that she tells you that she's going to do some bad things.
Sure,
that she
right.
She did some bad things, and that she's looking back on it. I also think, you know, for me, Brenda walks a line, and sometimes is a disagreeable character. And so it's like, well, what makes her tolerable? Why do we root for her then? That sort of thing. And so what she's doing, her telling of the novel, is remembering it. She's now an older woman. She lives in an assisted living facility. She is not entirely feeble because she's a force of nature, but she's aged now, and she's looking back, and her perspective on her young self, I think, and the situation that she's in brings it, actually for me, is what makes the love in a love story work. You know, Charlie and Brenda, without giving anything away, they have a fantastic first date. It goes mm-hmm. roughly at the beginning and then gets kind of worse and then is really fantastic. Great first date. And as she's telling the story of that, she steps out of the recollection for a moment to say, that was so good, I would give up 1 month of my remaining life to have 15 seconds of that date to just bump elbows with Charlie one more time.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we all know that we're mortal. And know that time will pass. And she has that awareness so that before their first kiss, they're like leaning toward each other for their first kiss. She's saying, they will, for every human being and every love affair, there will be a last kiss.
Yeah.
And that informs so much of her appreciation of the past and of her and her own imperfection. Sometimes she says, sometimes I want to shake that girl. If I could reach back, I'd give her such a swat. You know,
right.
Like she now understands her life in such a loving way. And because the book is in part about how Charlie and Brenda together seek redemption for helping to build the bomb, that tells you about whether or not they're able to find it, the love that she has in her later years.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned how she would like to go back in time and shake herself. The other character who'd like to shake her is her mother. And I absolutely love Brenda's relationship with her mother in the book. It is so beautifully rendered, and it is so perfectly fraught, and I loved her mother. And I also love, you know, I really like the friendships that Charlie develops with people like Giles.
Giles and Monroe, yep.
Yeah, as they work together. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about developing these sort of secondary relationships. They're not external characters, but they aren't the main characters. But I just to enrich the narrative.
It's a thing I'm learning. And if you were to put yourself through the ordeal of reading each of my novels in order, I think you would find that the minor characters improve in each one, that I'm really realizing that everyone, you know, can be a fully fleshed character with great economy, with, you know, just when we meet Brenda's mother, she is charging up the sidewalk, coming back from a ladies' luncheon, you know, with a purse the size of an aircraft carrier. You know, just kind of have that, like that big purse. It's like, we know her. And so I really took time to, like I said, the book took twice as long as any other one I've written. I took the time with the minor characters to really know them, to think about, like, Giles had four names before I settled on Giles. It took me a long time to decide who he was. And for a while, he had a drinking problem, and then he didn't, you know? And, I mean, I really had to spend, there's this one character, Monroe, who speaks with total cornpone Kentucky accent, except that he's a brilliant chemist with a PhD. And so, you know, so there's a richness for me with these characters that I feel great affection for them. I love Brenda's mother. And you know, when she's reading, I mean, she uses a cigarette like a prop, like Betty Davis. She's so good with her cigarette prop. And when she's reading, what she's reading, you know, for people who get the inside joke, at one point she's reading Johnny Tremaine, which was a bestseller in the 1940s and was one of my favorite books as a young adult, probably my favorite YA book.
And it's funny because you don't name the book. You just describe the book and I'm like, oh, that's Johnny Tremaine.
Yes, that's the idea. So it's a little inside joke to the reader.
Right.
You know, and on we go. But for me, it's like I put something I love in her hands because she has grown on me so much as a character. And in her kind of pragmatism, and you can see how Brenda is definitely her daughter in their relationship. And writing a mother-daughter relationship, I had no idea how much fun that would be.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're both kind of prickly. And there's a very brief argument they have in a train station that's about four sentences long. And it's like, I felt like I'd thrown a match on gasoline. It was really fun to have these characters feel more alive for me. And that was like a decision that I was not going to be quick with those characters, that I would take the time and I would trust the reader that it would be okay to take a couple of sentences to make them a little more vivid, to make them a little more specific and unique. And with the young men working on the bomb, I felt it was important to have, you know, fully fleshed, sympathetic characters with different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
One guy who says, we should do this. One guy who says, I'm not sure we should do this because of these moral implications. And then Charlie in his own inner torment about, you know, the component that he's building that is small but essential, and whether he should build it or not, and whether he's capable of building it or not. And so I needed to have that conversation, to have that debate among the three of them. They had to be equals on the page by the time they reached that moment.
It's interesting. I didn't think about this until right now, but and I don't have a question written down about it, but early in the book, in a different group of people, you describe where everybody sits, and Charlie sits in the middle. And now that you're mentioning his own concerns about the work they're doing, it makes me realize he's in the middle in a lot of situations.
Yes. Where I put him on the bus, where I put him in the, you know, anytime he's at a table, from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, when he sits, there are probably four or five times he sits down with people to have a meal, he's always in the middle.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Now, at one point, Brenda's mother tells her that she is spoiled. And so we learn that through dialogue. We see that happening through dialogue. And I thought that was an interesting point that we could talk about a little bit, because conveying information just through prose can get kind of boring, but conveying it through lots of different ways, including dialogue, I think makes it more interesting. I just wonder if you can talk about that and how much maybe you're cognizant of that while you're writing dialogue, that you're trying to convey some information.
Well, I always feel like some things are more believable if you don't to have it in prose. Like I've always felt the way that you convince people that a woman is beautiful is you have men react to her, and the reader will get it. The reader will go, oh, she must be beautiful, you know, by the way that these men have been making fools of themselves or whatever. And sometimes with dialogue, particularly when characters are in disagreement in the dialogue, sometimes a declaration like, you know, you're spoiled, and it's okay, I still love you, but you're spoiled. You know, is saying it as a fact, you realize, oh, look at these behaviors. You know, like, I think, like, it's almost like the that portion of the puzzle, you just got the piece that goes in the middle, and now the image is clear. Yeah. And so I do it very sparingly, because I don't want it to be just like, what's the, you know, as you know, Tom, right? Those expository things, like, I just won't do that. As you know, Tom, if the moon is in this phase, you know, the tides right. will be this way, and we'll never make it to, you know, I don't want to do any of that, right? I zero of that. But if people are arguing and somebody says, well, look, you're the one who lost the lighter, which is in the thing I'm writing now, is somebody who lost the lighter. Yeah. And no one will say who lost the lighter until finally somebody says, you're the one who lost the lighter. And as soon as he says it, we're like, oh, yeah, he's the one.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. There's a way, it's like an affirmation for the reader.
So I was going to ask you eventually what you're writing next. Do you want to talk about that now, what you're working on?
Sure. You know, it's fun for me because some of this book takes place in Vermont, where I live. And so that's a first for me. It also takes place in the depth of winter, which I love and which most people fear or dislike. And so it is about three young men who are two of them are Vermonters, and they live in New York City. And one of the guys is about to get married, and they're doing a fancy bachelor party weekend of skiing up at Mount Tremblant. And this older man, who's a client of one of the young men, says, you know, you were doing work for me that caused you to miss your, you know, your train. So I will fly you up in my personal airplane to make it up to you. And just after they fly over the border into Canada, the plane springs an oil leak, and it doesn't crash, but they have to put down on a frozen lake in the wilds of southern Canada. And they do not trust the ice, especially with fuel on it, to hold them. So they have to leave the plane, and it is late January, and it's snowing. And there's not only is there a blizzard beginning, but behind that, there's very, very cold air. And so it is to some extent a survival story. And it is mostly told by the tracker, who is considered one of the great trackers in the world, who is hired to go find them. And this tracker is a very unusual, very powerful and knowledgeable and spiritual woman. And so her relationship with the wilds in winter is a spiritual one. While her task is very matter of fact to find these three men before they freeze to death. And so that's I'm about just about halfway along with that.
Wow. And, that sounds fantastic.
It is. Thank you. I mean, one of the things I'm loving is I'm liberated from the wartime timetable, and it's a cast of four, basically. There are a couple minor characters, you know, three of them, four of them, but, you know, there are scenes in Universe of Two that have more characters in them than the entirety of this novel. This novel could almost be like a stage play. It's so pared down, and I'm really loving that.
That's great. Well, your book sounds great. And I wanted to also know if you've read anything by other authors recently that you might recommend to listeners.
You know, one of the really fun things about the book that I'm writing now is that I'm not doing tons and tons of research reading. And so I've been able to spoil myself, and I've been reading a lot of fiction by friends and contemporary stuff. Can I just rattle some off? I mean, there's
a
bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved The Overstory. I loved All Is Not Forgotten by Wendy Walker. I liked Her Last Flight I loved all of these, but Her Last Flight by Beatrice Williams, I thought was great. Lines of New York by Fiona Davis, terrific book. With or Without You by Caroline Levitt. I'm late to her. I didn't know she's had like 10 fantastic books. And I read this one and like, wow, does she make this look effortless? Which means she's obviously worked very hard.
Right.
The Red Lotus by Chris Bogalian, you know, really, really terrific book. You know, a thriller, but it has a poignancy to it, a heart to it that I don't usually see in thrillers. And that makes it kind of touching. And the book I've just begun is You Again by Deborah Immergut. And, and I'm really liking that so far. So, you know, what that is like a half a dozen, you know, next on my table after that is Musical Chairs by Amy Poppel. You know, I think, I can't remember the name of it, but the guy who wrote The Gentleman in Moscow, Amor Towles, he has another novel, and that's next on my stack.
Yeah, that was excellent. That was, The Rules of Civility.
Rules of Civility, right.
That was excellent.
I feel like just because of, you know, that's what people have said. I feel like the voice was, in Gentleman of Moscow, was so strong that I want to break. between him. So it'll probably be about 10 books between books, but I want to read more by him because that one was so good.
Yeah.
So it's a real pleasure to me right now. And then about a half dozen books of poetry, because I'm always devouring that stuff too.
Yeah.
It's really great to be able to sort of catch up. Because if you're writing about the atomic bomb, for example, you're going to go read 5,000 pages.
Just
to get the basics. You just are. You have to, you know?
Right.
So you don't just say something that's just patently false or dumb. And so so I'm really enjoying reading friends and contemporary work. Now, one of the things that's I don't want to say gratifying. I don't know what the right word is, but it is so great that these books are good. They're really good. The level of craft is high. The concept is high. The kind of writing virtues of clarity and vividness and, you know, unique living, breathing characters. Like there is a lot of good stuff being written in America right now,
mm-hmm.
and being published in America right now. I think that is so good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like an unspoken for all the difficulties in our culture. That is a good sign in my mind.
Yeah. Stephen, I just have one last question for you. I usually like to finish these interviews asking for sort of directed advice. And in your case, I wanted to ask you about setting. Your setting in Universe of Two changes drastically through the book from Chicago to the desert. And your details of setting, I found always very perfect for the moment. And I, like, there's this moment where they're on a date in Chicago, and I think it's snowing, and a man is maybe singing, and they put some money in the bucket. I don't know. It was like these details of setting are very evocative. So I wondered if you can offer advice for choosing relevant details of setting that contribute to the narrative.
You know, long ago, a friend of mine who was an actor told me that the most valuable thing you could have on stage is a prop.
Mm.
He said, give him a hat. He can show 99 different expressions and emotions with that hat. Give him a pipe. You know, maybe it's in his mouth. Maybe he never even puts it in his mouth. But it's a thing that he can work with. And that has stuck with me in fiction. You know, does a character have something in their hand? Are they doing something?
Right.
And in fact, in a great many of my scenes, someone is busy doing something while a conversation is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like how that makes scenes kind of livelier, and there's a direction that they're going. There's multiple layers that are possible. The setting is that way as well. Many years ago, I had the good fortune to travel to Africa, to East Africa. And I spent the first night in Nairobi, and then one night kind of getting out in the hinterlands. And then the night after that, I was in the Maasai Mara, you know, one of the most beautiful and wild places on earth. And the thing, all night I kept waking up because of the birds. There were bird calls I didn't recognize, and there were hundreds of them. There were so many birds. And I realized that if I were ever going to write about Africa, there would have to be birds in it. And then I realized if I'm ever going to have to write about anywhere, there have to be birds in it. And that became kind of a rule for me, right? Not that, like, you won't see birds flying all through my fiction, but it's more to say, like, there are real places, you know, which means I have to go to Los Alamos. I have to see what it's like. And if I can't go there in four seasons, I need to look at films and photos and descriptions of the other seasons so I can understand what this place is like. And if it's not birds, it's kinds of flowers, and there are very specific flowers multiple times in Universe of Two. There is the Chicago weather, and I did spend a couple of years in the Midwest. I was in Iowa, but Chicago's where I went for kind of urban culture when I wanted it. And, you know, there's a particular misery to Chicago winter. It always surprises me when it's well done, when there is smell as a way of conveying place.
Right.
Sarah Stewart Taylor just did The Mountains Wild, a novelist in Vermont, and she conveys in Ireland where, like, I feel at the end of it like I've been smelling burning peat and dripping and drinking pints. It's so vivid, you know. And
right.
And that's so smell really helps. Temperature helps. You know, it's summer in New Mexico is hot, and so these people are often hot. And so it's part of like it's remembering that there are birds in Africa, and so I will go find out when I'm going to setting. I'll find out what plants grow, what trees grow, what if it's a city, what's traffic like. There's one point where they go on a drive through Chicago to get to a train station, and they want to take the long way. So I had to figure out what was the short way, what was the long way. Did that long way exist in 1943? That was all about like making it as real in the reader's imagination as I can. Mm-hmm. And one of the hard things about the book I'm writing now, because it's deep winter, is there aren't a lot of critters. There's no flowers. There is, there's weather.
Right.
And there's hibernating animals and those that don't. And I don't have the same vocabulary of ways to evoke setting. But I think that we all have had the experience of reading a dialogue in a novel, even in a good novels, even in novels way better than mine, where suddenly it's just two sets of voices alternating lines, and we don't get a sense of what are they doing during this?
Right.
What are they holding? What else is happening? Where are they?
Right. What did they see? And, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And it's rare that people actually look at one another in the eyes. So what are they looking at? What are they holding? What are they doing? And I'm over answering this, but I feel like for me, that's a lot of how you make it's all in service of the reader's imagination. It's
great.
All in service of the reader's imagined experience. Because yeah. I don't think you can really get to his or her heart unless they hear that bird, they smell that smell, they feel that sun on their face.
Okay, wonderful. I want to just mention again, the name of the novel is Universe of Two by Stephen P. Kiernan and published by William Morrow. Stephen, I really appreciated your time today. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
You asked the best questions. I'm happy to do it. Absolutely.
Thank you so much. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Stephen P. Kiernan about his new novel, Universe of Two, published by William Morrow. You can learn more about Stephen's work at his website, stephenpkiernan.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest in my conversation with Stephen P. Kiernan. We discussed setting, and he mentioned that weather and birds and smell all contribute to making a fully realized setting. Conjure a very specific setting, not just location, but time of day, weather, and other factors that leave no doubt in any reader's mind where that place is and what it is like. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. The Vermont Humanities Council will be holding their 47th annual fall conference, the theme of which is Democracy 2020. The plan is to offer up to 15 different sessions, both online and in person, for the fall conference. Every Wednesday night, something will happen through the end of September. You can find out more information about what those events will be like at vermonthumanities.org. Northshire Books in Manchester will invite people to join in from home for a conversation between Martha Ackman and Marta McDowell. They'll be talking about Emily Dickinson. Tuesday, August 25th at 5. More information at northshire.com. The Fletcher Free Library in Burlington presents Write, 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 a Grab the Mic, Tell Your Story video series with the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, Jason Reynolds. That's Tuesday, August 25th and Thursday, August 27th at 10:30 in the morning. More information at fletcherfree.org. Northshire Books in Manchester Center presents Northshire Live. Carrie Arsenault, author of Milltown, will be in conversation with Marcia DeSanctis. Thursday, August 27th at 5. More information at northshire.com. The South Burlington Community Library presents an evening book discussion about A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. Thursday, August 27th at 6:30. More information by emailing sbplinfo@southburlingtonvt.gov. And finally, the Fletcher Free Library in Burlington presents Stories with 2020 Imagine Your Story Summer Reading Champion, Carmen Agra Didi. That's August 28th at noon. More information at FletcherFree.org. So each week at the end of the show, I've been speaking a little bit about the pandemic, encouraging listeners to try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I still hope you're able to do this. I also hope that you're able to read and write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.